prospective parents have always had a lot to think about when deciding whether to have kids. Financial and career stuff, the state of their relationship to their partner if they have one, and whether they're ready to take on so much responsibility. But for most people who just knew they wanted a baby, the biggest question was not whether, but when. Now, though, there may be people who would love to be parents but feel they can't, in good conscience, bring a child into the world right now. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. At the heart of many Americans' reluctance to have children are worries about climate change. If the new person they bring into the world is doomed to suffer on a dying planet, if their very existence creates a carbon footprint that makes the problem even worse, it seems irresponsible, maybe even selfish, to procreate. The thing is, the calculations are not as simple as it might seem. My guest isn't trying to pressure anybody into having kids, but if you've wanted them and thought you shouldn't have them for environmental reasons, you're going to want to hear what he's learned. Brian Walsh is editor of Vox's Future Perfect. You can find his article, Yes, You Can Have Kids and Fight Climate Change at the Same Time, online at Vox.com. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Okay, the replacement rate of reproduction is something like 2.1 births per American woman. We are below that at the moment, not expected to get back there anytime soon. What does that mean for population projections into the future?
Well, it means that just based off people reproducing, that eventually you'll have population growth slow, which is what's been happening in the United States and really much of the world. And then eventually, potentially over time, you start to have population dwindle. And in between that, you have what we're seeing now, which is increasing aging in the population, smaller family sizes. Basically, it's simple math. You know, if you don't have enough children, then that 2.1 comes from, obviously, one child to replace the mother, one child to replace the father, and then a little extra to make up for it. You will eventually have that slow down, which we're seeing, and then eventually shrinking.
I was interested to learn that births per woman is yet another seemingly apolitical phenomenon that seems in recent years to have been shaped by partisan leanings. How does that play out?
Well, I think you see a lot of this from the conservative side that, is this due to changes in what people want? Is it due to women being in the workforce? You know, I think it often gets coded in this kind of way, like, oh, if this is something you care about, if this is something you're talking about, it means you must be conservative, you want to kind of roll the clock back. But, you know, I don't think that's quite fair because for one thing, you know, this benefits us all. I mean, we kind of do need more children. We think about the economic consequences of a slowing and declining population. That's pretty serious. That's not a political issue, really. But, you know, what struck me also was that, you know, when you ask people, okay, what is the kind of ideal family size? How many children would do you think you should have or people should have or would want to have? It's, you know, a good one child higher than the number they're actually having, which to me at least indicates that whatever political party you belong to, there is an unmet desire out there to have more kids. And for whatever reason, people are not getting there. They either they think they shouldn't or they feel economically they can't. But, you know, that unmet need to me, that's a big point here because I think that's important. And we should think about what are the policies or changes we can make to help meet that need.
Because this is not just about climate concerns. It's also not just a U.S. phenomenon, right? Birth rates are dropping throughout most of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, other countries are seeing this at a much steeper rate than the United States. You have, obviously, a lot of countries in East Asia and Japan. This has been the case for quite a while. South Korea, China, which may actually see its population now shrinking, which is kind of hard to believe. Also in Europe, certainly, parts of South America, really outside some parts of South Asia, and especially sub-Saharan Africa, where you still have much higher fertility rates, although those have been coming down as well, this is a pretty global phenomenon. And it's going to be one of those phenomena, I think, that is really going to remake and shift what the world will look like in 30, 40, 50 years' time. It's hard to imagine that, but you know, if you're living with growth for so long, we are in sight of a moment where, you know, world population might actually peak and might begin to roll back. And in between that, we see really different growth rates in different parts of the world.
So one reason for those declines in global birth rates is that women are having their first child later. Broadly speaking, this is thought to be a good thing for families, but it does mean a smaller window, right, in which people have an opportunity to become parents.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is a function I think we can see that in our own lives, and people are getting more educated, they're spending more time in school, they're spending more time in their career. They want and need more and deserve more, frankly, from that side of their lives. The flip side of that, of course, is you might then marry later, which has definitely been happening. If you are able to get married, because that's been declined to a certain extent as well. And when you start to have that first child later in your life, you're past 30, for instance, yeah, it just leaves less time to have more, even if you do want that. And that's on top of things like the incredibly high cost of childcare, other sort of demands that just make it hard, even if you got to that one, to get to two or that even three that you might think you want, but aren't able to really plan your life out in a way that makes that work for you.
This is really extraordinary. Polling suggests that today, almost a quarter of U.S. adults of childbearing age say climate change has made them at least reconsider having children. When those worries center around the well-being of that potential child, what kinds of fears do people talk about?
Well, I think people look at what is being in some ways forecast in some parts of some climate models that, well, the world is going to get worse. It's going to get hotter. You'll see more extreme weather. You're potentially bringing a child into the world. And is it going to be facing a catastrophe in 20, 30, 40 years time? I understand that. That fear is real. I understand why that might be holding some people back. I think, you know, when you dig into some of the information around climate science, absolutely, climate change will continue to get worse. One of the really important things to remember about climate change is that it is cumulative. Even if we were to shut down all carbon emissions tomorrow, the carbon we put in the atmosphere, you know, up until now, will continue to warm the atmosphere. This is something that doesn't get better for quite a long time, even if assuming we take it much more seriously than we do now. So I understand that fear. But that said, you know, very few models suggest that your child, if you have one now, is likely here in the United States to be living when they're 30, 40 in some kind of, I don't know, Mad Max climate hellscape. You know, it will be difficult. It can be adapted to. So my personal feeling is that, you know, you can do that. Like, you know, you're not dooming your child almost certainly. But the fact that that feeling is out there, I mean, that I understand that would add to some of these other things that are holding people back from perhaps having the children that, again, they may actually think they want.
But, and climate change is very important, but there are other metrics to consider, right? I mean, based on many other measures, a child born almost anywhere in the world today has a better shot at a good and a long life than at any other time in human history.
That's really important to remember. And it's hard to keep in mind, I think, because it requires you to sort of think back past 200 years ago, before the Industrial Revolution, before the sort of big boost of economic growth and scientific advancement that we experienced in that. And frankly, life expectancies were far shorter. About, I think, you know, go back to 1800, they're about half what they are now. You know, we didn't have antibiotics. We didn't have cures to diseases. War was much more common. Violence was much more common. I mean, if I were, I don't know, alive in 1700, I would be much more worried about what kind of life my child would have at that moment than I do now, even with climate change included. So it's a hard thing sometimes to keep those two facts in mind. On one hand, yes, we face a future that's going to be challenging, very challenging, actually. And we can't fully foresee what that will look like. But when you look at the picture historically throughout all the time people have been making these decisions or not making these decisions, you know, 2023 is still pretty good, perhaps still the best year possible to actually make that decision, actually have that child.
Brian, it stands to reason that a human not born obviously will not use a lifetime's worth of resources, right? Energy, food, manufactured goods, water, housing. But this is really fascinating. What did you learn about how the carbon footprint of a baby born today in the United States is expected to compare with the carbon footprint of that baby's parents?
This was really fascinating to me because you're absolutely right. Yeah, you know, you have a child, that child will consume energy, will consume resources. But because we've actually been able to decarbonize the economy over time, we're putting in more renewable energy, we're using energy more efficiently, we're kind of reducing the individual carbon footprint each person has. That child born now, the carbon footprint of that baby over the lifetime could actually be 10 times smaller than that of their grandparents, and also smaller than that of their parents. And that's because back then we used more carbon to get the energy we needed to consume the resources we consumed. If we expect that to continue to fall over time, which it is, and it will almost certainly continue, each of those children, they're going to be using up less, they're going to be contributing less to climate change than, again, their parents or grandparents would. And that, to me, sort of underscores that this isn't as simple as something that stays constant all the time. You know, these children can or be using things more efficiently. And who knows, they may also be contributing to those solutions as well, because it's not just a matter of what we don't do when it comes to climate change. It's a matter also of what we do, what we can innovate, what we can change politically. And, you know, the next generation is going to have to be an incredibly important part of that.
So a lot of people thinking about this today, whether they realize it or not, are operating off these calculations that were released in 2009 about the lifetime environmental impact of children. Those calculations weren't fraudulent, but were they misinterpreted?
I think they were somewhat misinterpreted, but more importantly, when they were made, they really were just sort of taking the economy as it was and assuming really nothing would change in the future. You know, imagine if you had 2009, it doesn't change. We don't add more solar. We don't add more nuclear. We don't add anything along those lines. We don't change how we farm. We don't change how we eat. Okay, fine. And if that's the case, then you could expect that carbon footprint to be frozen for every generation going on. And on top of that, they also attributed not just that child's future carbon footprint, but portions of any descendants they might have. So you can imagine you have a child, they have children, so forth and so on, going on and on. All of that somehow gets wrapped up into the carbon footprint of that individual child. And that seems, that really kind of weights it more towards being larger than it would otherwise be. And again, I think important to remember, it doesn't imagine a world where we continue to innovate, where we continue to change politically, where we continue to make the world a better place. And that's the product of people at the end of the day.
But do those smaller calculations that we have now, are they contingent on meeting climate targets? Is there reason to be optimistic that we will actually get to our goals on this?
Yeah, I mean, they are contingent on the idea that we'll continue to meet climate goals, we'll meet stricter climate goals in the future. I can't tell that future. I mean, it's possible that might not happen. It's possible that we might suddenly shift around this. But when I look at the general sort of energy going into climate action, when I look at the energy around how we produce and use energy, I think it's much more likely to bet on the idea that we will be meeting a lot of those goals. Will we get to zero carbon by 2050? I don't know. Like, that's going to be a steep goal to hit. But I think there's enough of a possibility out there that if that was the sort of question you were kind of pondering as you decide whether you do want to have that child, I don't think that should be something that holds you back necessarily, you know, because I think at the end of the day that we can move towards making the world a better place. And you shouldn't just assume that, you know, that we're doomed in that way. If you really feel that way, then yes, probably shouldn't have children. But I don't think that's the direction the world's going.
And here's the thing. There will be some consequences if we get the birth rate back up to somewhere close to replacement rate. There will also be consequences if we don't, right? As it stands now, by 2034, there will be more Americans over 65 than under 18. I mean, this is partially because longevity has increased, but that is not likely to change anytime soon. So what we're looking at is that the imbalance between the very old and the very young is going to continue to grow.
Right, and we're already seeing that play out right now. And you're right, this is a good thing. A lot of these consequences are mostly positive effects that now we have to sort of grapple with, okay, what new problems did they create? So people are, for the most part, living longer. They have been living longer. That means you're going to have that older baby boomer generation. They're in retirement now. They're going to be elderly. You have fewer kids. From an economic perspective, of course, you know, we need those younger workers to support elderly retirees. We also need them to start new businesses. We need them to just contribute to the economy and to innovation more generally. And a society that is really heavily weighted towards the elderly is one that, you know, most likely is going to be less innovative. It'll be less productive at the end of the day. And so, you know, I think that's part of the idea that, yes, we actually do need these children. That it's not just a matter of like, well, how much carbon are they going to add to the atmosphere? I mean, if we want to keep this country going, if we want to keep this country vibrant, that's a really important part of it. And, you know, I don't know whether we'll ever get back to 2.1. That would be a pretty sharp increase. Again, like, I think people should be able to have the children they want to have. We try to make that possible as much as possible. But, you know, that also means looking at other areas where we can change the population dynamics, looking at immigration, for instance. You know, the United States is in a really good position there where people want to come to the United States. That's not true of all the countries going through this demographic transition. That's another area where you can sort of bring in younger people, not children, but bring in younger workers, and they can sort of begin to change some of these dynamics as well.
Are you hearing from politicians who are interested in changing immigration policy specifically to bring in an influx of younger people?
No, not really. And I think that underscores like a really important point here, which is that as you started the show, I mean, this is a very politically fraught issue. I think on both sides, you know, people don't want to be told what they should or shouldn't do. You know, there are two different perspectives on this. And I think for immigration, that's clearly the case as well. You know, we are probably going to be held back on immigration. In fact, we have been. We've seen it really decline for the most part the last number of years. And as much as it's clear, anyone who's worried about this issue, who's worried about the graying of America, or eventually the population decline of America, knows that immigration is the solution you can tap quickly. Even if you have more children, it takes obviously 18 years, 20 years for them to even begin to enter the workforce. Immigrants can do that right now, but you know, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that this is a highly fraught issue. It's very hard to find compromise on it. And I do worry that's something we're going to lose. And there are many other reasons to support immigration beyond this, but just from the sheer idea of how do you keep this country dynamic? How do you keep it productive? That's probably the fastest solution we can do to turn on that tap.
Most parents understand that having children is no guarantee that those children will grow up and care for them in old age. That said, there are already a huge number of aging adults without any kids who even might potentially look after them later in life, right?
That's absolutely true. I mean, this phenomena of growing childless aging Americans is something we're already beginning to see. It's only set to grow, obviously, because we've seen, you know, the decline in fertility over time. Therefore, it makes sense that as you know, today's middle-aged adults become elderly, become retirees, you will see more of them who don't have children. And, you know, as family sizes themselves shrink, you even lose some of those sort of secondary connections. You know, you have fewer uncles and aunts, you have fewer nephews and nieces, you have just a shrinking of American family life. And I do worry a little bit about that. You know, I worry about who will look after them. I worry about what that will be like. That's something that's really quite new. You know, we always had childless adults, but they tended to occur within sort of the atmosphere of a larger family overall. You know, so there might be other people to help look out for them. But increasingly, that's not going to be the case. In Japan, which is much more advanced along this, this is a huge issue. China, where, of course, they've had the one-child policy until recently, another really important problem where you just don't have the family to look after elderly adults. You also don't have a state that really even has what the United States can do when it comes to things like Social Security. So that, to me, is going to be an enormous impact going forward. And I worry about that. I don't have any logical solutions. I mean, in Japan, they look to things like automation, robots, looking to deal with elder care. But, you know, this is something that is kind of built in based on the kind of lives people choose to have, ultimately.
And even if we set aside filial obligations altogether, at the very least, we're going to need younger workers to provide care for older folks, right? Home health aides and doctors and nurses and drivers, that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that's something to really think about. Again, you know, I don't think anyone likes to think of children as automatically future workers, future cogs in the economic machine, but that is a very true reality. I think we're already seeing some elements of that. You know, there's a huge crisis in healthcare, in, as you mentioned, elder care, all forms of care, really, because these are very labor-intensive professions. They're not things that can be easily automated. And, you know, I don't know where those workers will come from. You know, again, immigration is one source potentially, but that's politically problematic. If we continue down the demographic path we're going, you know, I can definitely foresee a situation where there's going to be a tremendous shortage, and I'm not sure how our society will really deal with that. You know, I think without the people to do that kind of care, I don't know who will do it.
Right. So it's not even necessarily something where we can guarantee ourselves that we can buy our way out of this problem. We might have plenty of money in later life and still not be able to find anybody to help us.
Exactly right. I mean, you see this right now. Like if you can't find the workers, businesses are kind of out of luck in that way. And that's going to be especially true for elder care. Obviously, those who have means, who have resources, you know, they'll probably be in a better place. They'll be better positioned to take care of themselves or, you know, hire someone else to do that. But you know, the competition for that is going to be pretty high. And for those who don't have those resources, I could foresee a situation where those last decade, two decades of life could be quite difficult.
Which could also put a burden on the government if, you know, a couple generations from now, the federal government has to step in to solve this problem.
Precisely. You know, and we're already in a situation where, you know, we're facing a future where Social Security has funding only so long. Again, that's somewhat of a pyramid scheme where you count on those larger numbers of young workers to pay into that system, to then support the retirees in retirement. You know, you take out the bottom layer of that pyramid, you shrink that, There's less in the way of support for that. But, you know, already we see politics that is in many ways dominated by the needs of older Americans. They vote obviously in greater numbers. They have a very loud voice. Okay, fine. Maybe we'll have a situation where we do devote more of the resources there, but that will come potentially at the expense of other things we might need, whether we're talking about thinking about climate change, whether we're talking about schools, we're talking about cities. You know, we have limited resources. And if we don't have the ability to continue replenishing that, and at the end of the day, it's people, and the economy is people doing work, people consuming, people making. If we don't have that, you know, we face a future where growth shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And that's not a good place to be, because it's not just about how rich will people be, how well off will they be, but a society where you're seeing that shrink over time, where you're seeing growth become a distant possibility, is one I think that it's less fair. It's ultimately less liberal in a sense, as people sort of become more worried about what's my future going to be like versus what the sort of broader future is like, and more pessimistic as well. I mean, all those things are, they're not really, it's not really the country I'd kind of want to live in, I think, is what I mean.
Brian, here's the thing. We can pat ourselves on the back, and should, for our work ethic and productivity growth and all of that. But the reality is U.S. economic growth has been in part a factor of population growth for a really long time now. Will global economies necessarily stagnate if the sum total it means that there are fewer and fewer people on the planet over the years?
Well, unless something really changes about how the global economy works, I mean, that does seem to be the case. Now, of course, you know, I mentioned, I think earlier when we were talking about climate change, I can't tell the future quite yet. So, you know, we are seeing things like automation, AI, that might shift that. It already has shifted, obviously. You know, we get a lot more out of every individual worker. You mentioned that productivity growth. That's largely because we've been able to add machines, and those machines have made those human workers more productive. Now, you know, if the next generation of AI can really start to take work that humans can that are doing right now, all right, maybe you still have growth, even without more people. But there's no guarantee that's the case. And obviously, that's never happened historically. And you see, again, you look at countries like Japan, it has slowed down, it's declined significantly. There's elements where that slowdown in population, that plays a role there too. So I think that's the future you're headed towards, barring some pretty significant technological shift.
And economic growth is not only a matter of having a lot of people around to buy stuff, right? There's also this reality that you've alluded to already, that innovation has historically come principally from younger adults. What kind of talent and development might we miss out on if the workforce is skewed older and older as time goes on?
You know, I know I'm 44 years old myself, and it like pains me to actually see this kind of research, but there is really just no doubt that that is mostly the case, that when you look at great achievements, when you look at certain people who are starting really big businesses, even down to how old Nobel Prize winners are when they're doing their research, it does tend to happen younger. You know, you're obviously fresh out of college or school. You know, you have a more plastic brain, you're more willing to challenge things, you become more sclerotic in your thinking often as you get older. So when we see the balance of the population moving in that direction, it's hard to see that pairing with really strong innovation. You know, as you get older, you have more to lose, you're going to be less of a risk taker. So that's kind of where we'd be likely going as our population gets older and then potentially eventually does begin to decline.
Starting with Thomas Malthus, all the way into the 20th century with Paul Ehrlich, we've had real anxieties at different times over whether we were making too many people for the planet to sustain. Did those predictions have a measurable impact on birth rates? I mean, I'm thinking that in Malthus's era, people didn't have a whole lot of control over this.
I don't think in Malthus's case, they had a lot of control over that. You're absolutely right. You know, you talk about Paul Ehrlich, and that's during the 1960s, early 70s. There was a lot of concern at that moment. And at that time, fertility rates were quite high, much, much higher than they are now. And they did start to decline really quickly in the aftermath of those kind of warnings. But it's hard to sort of get out causation there. Like, I think there's evidence those were already on the decline for a lot of basic reasons. As people live longer, as child mortality drops, people feel the need to have fewer children. Children are going to school, they require more resources. So it's not as, frankly, economically productive for families to have more of them. You're putting in more cost, you're not getting more benefit until later on in your life. So I think that was going to happen anyway, but you know, I understand why those warnings existed when they when they did. But the reality is, this is such a universal phenomenon. You know, there's a, they call this a demographic transition because it is fairly universal. As a country gets richer, as people live longer, they have fewer children. Now, we haven't gotten to see what the other side of this ultimately looks like. We know what sort of really high levels of fertility look like, a very fast growth, but also a lot of strain on resources. You know, at this point, we're in uncharted territory. So, you know, I don't know quite what this is going to look like, but it's happening for a lot of reasons. You mentioned climate change is also happening just because of economic shifts, shifts in how people want to spend their time, but also, you know, the feeling that it takes a lot of resources to have a kid today. It takes a lot of money. And that's one area where I think government actually can make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, if assuming that you've convinced some folks that we might want to bring U.S. birth rates back up a little bit, one challenge is that once those numbers start to decline, it can be hard for public policy to turn the ship around. What might work to make more adults of childbearing age think having a child is a possibility for them?
I mean, the one thing that, that seems to have had some really sustainable success elsewhere in the world is simply more government support for childcare, which makes sense. If you're going to have a situation where, as we do in the United States, where, you know, most often both parents are working or you often have single parents, the cost of just caring for that child day by day, especially in the early stages before they can go to school or frankly after school, because as we all know, school and working schedules rarely actually pair up. As much as you can take some of that burden off parents, that really does free them up. It frees them up potentially to have more children. It certainly frees them up just to be happier, to be better parents, I would imagine as well. So that's one thing we think we can definitely do. Another thing, especially in really high cost metro areas, I mean, I live in New York City and this is a huge issue here, is the cost of housing. You know, I mean, kids need space, adults need space as well. And when housing is incredibly expensive, when you're kind of restraining the supply on housing, that's going to keep people from having kids as well, or cause them to leave the city altogether. I think it's really notable that you're seeing more growth, more fertility, often in states, like Texas for that matter, where that cost of housing is a little lower, where the cost of living is lower. At the end of the day, there is a dollar cents formula here, and whatever can be done around policy to try to lighten the burden on parents or prospective parents, that's probably the best we can do. And if nothing else, it makes the lives better for families in the United States. So I think that by itself is a worthy goal, but if it also does something around this demographic challenge, that's a great side benefit as well.
Are there ways, do you think, to make such incentives available without turning this into something that feels very politically polarized?
Absolutely, I think so. You know, one thing I would definitely have us avoid is what you see in countries like Hungary, for instance, where there are, you know, outright cash bonuses for having children. Often those kind of policies, especially in that country, they really are done with a specific mindset that, oh, we need a specific kind of population. We don't want immigrants. We want, say, native-born white Hungarians to have more children because we're worried about not just the size of the country, but the sort of makeup of it. And we would not want to do that ever, I think, in the United States. So rather, you're looking for areas where there are economic burdens on parents, or again, would-be parents. How can that be lightened? Because I actually think there are benefits that go beyond that. You know, I mean, if you can make it easier for parents to function in a city like, again, New York, that's going to be better for New York, for them to stay there, for their tax dollars to stay there, for their economic productivity to stay there. So I think that's where you want to go. You don't want to be having any kind of policy that smacks of population control in either direction. Rather, you want to say, okay, it's in the benefit of this country to make life easier for parents, to make it more possible for them to have more children if they want. Where can we actually attack that? What are the sort of choke points that maybe we can loosen a little bit and make those decisions people are making and make their lives for the next 18, 20 years or so with those children a little bit easier?
I want to finish with this, Brian. Reading this piece made me think about the fact that in this era where we've all become more comfortable with sharing our struggles publicly, parents are not exactly great ambassadors for the joys of raising a family. Like every think piece on parenthood is mostly about what an agonizing slog it is, even though I think most parents would tell you that's only part of the story. Can we find a balance between sharing our struggles about this very challenging thing people do and not making it sound like something only an idiot would willingly sign up for?
That's such a great point. You know, there was a great book a few years back. It was All Joy, No Fun, describing modern parenthood, where we're just to feel this joy, but really day to day, it's as if everything is just a slog. Which I get, like, I, you know, my wife and I have a 5.5-year-old son, and there's a lot of joy. There's also fun as well. I think we definitely could tell a different story around that. But, you know, I think this also gets at some of the things that hold people back as well, which is those stories make it seem as if being a parent is just a hellish experience, or you will have no time for anything else in your life. And I don't really think that's the case. I mean, certainly, again, with these policies, perhaps we could do some things to make that even less the case. But yeah, I think as much as we can spread that message that not only is it a joyful experience, but yeah, you might actually have time to have a life outside your child as well. That, you know, being a parent is a part of your life. It does not have to consume your entire life. And I think, you know, that feeds into this idea that, you know, your children have to be the best they can be, or they won't be able to succeed in the world. I don't think that's really true, but, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. If there's one message to take away from that, you know, it doesn't have to be something that is economically crippling, personally crippling. It's a lovely experience if you want it. And, you know, we can continue to make it less of a burden, but, you know, really, it's also pretty great too.
Brian Walsh is editor of Vox's Future Perfect. You can find his article, Yes, You Can Have Kids and Fight Climate Change at the Same Time, online at vox.com. Brian, thanks very much for talking us through this.
Thank you very much as well.